Our next case is 2017-1078, the Columbus Bar Association versus Kingsley Frampton Nice. For the respondent, Mr. Nice.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I am Kinsley Nice. I'm respondent to this case, and I would like to proceed with your leave. I will try to reserve 3 minutes, and I will be mindful of the clock. This case begins at the end of a trial in Common Pleas Court in Columbus, Ohio, Franklin County. A client that I represented lost the case. Honorable Judge Alan Travis, who I think a lot of, and bless his soul, made the decisions. He decided that the two witnesses that I represented had lied in depositions and lied in trial testimony and had falsified in fraud and felony fraud documents presented at trial. Until the moment of trial began, when my witness, the representative for the company, the only one I'd worked with, although there was a second I did then also work with, sat and told me that we were in deep trouble because the anomalies that they were suggesting were not anomalies. He'd falsified and lied. They really limited me during the trial. It limited me a lot. Could only do certain things. Well, Judge Travis decided that the award should go against them. I withdrew from the case in September of 2013. Other counsel took over from, from Retzel and Andrus, Steve Jones. We got along great, transitioned everything the way I'm supposed to. It was very personable, very decent. He took on the Court of Appeals. In 2014, he started to write me letters. His appeal had been processed through the 10th District. Those letters demanded that I do certain things, five things. And these five things are the basis that start my difficulties that bring me with you and difficulties with the Columbus Bar Association. The first of these is they were claiming that I had committed malpractice and they were going to litigate that. And they provided an expert's opinion with those letters. They provided that to the Columbus Bar Association as well. And they demanded that I do certain things. Then the Columbus Bar demanded that I comply with Retzel and Andrus and Stephen Jones and do these things. The second thing that he had was they wanted me to extend the statute of limitations to sue me, which would have been September 23rd of 2014. I apologize, 214. Got to get all my dates right. That was my choice. At this point, we have the Bar Association interfering with private litigation, threatened litigation, threatened litigation. The third thing that they have is counsel demands that I write back and forth with Mr. Jones and answer all his questions and provide him documents, not about his clients, not about his case. He's already gone to the Court of Appeals. I'd provided everything, receipts, good emails back and forth confirming. Now the Bar Association says, we're ordering you to provide these items to Mr. Jones. Again, interfering with private litigation matters. I don't want to get sued. Then the fourth thing they're saying is that I didn't provide to these clients, two entities, an incorporated entity and LLC, a form that says, I don't carry insurance. My representative that I dealt with was here in Columbus, Ohio. It's the only person I ever met face to face, only had marginal contact, we'll call it the Chicago group, over time. Immediately upon that request from the Columbus Bar Association, literally within 2 days, about June 10th of 2014, through counsel, I provided two forms that I'd had over time. I'd had three, but my office had been flooded and paper documents were done. I was in an office down here with Don McTighe at Jennifer Bruner's old offices, and one of the county commissioners, Paula Brooks, was on my floor. She lost everything. I lost everything. 5 computers, everything. This all fits in a little bit later when I'm telling you that I didn't get due process in my hearing with the panel.
Counsel, did you have malpractice insurance?
No. Never
have
in my career.
Did you notify your clients you did not have malpractice insurance?
Yes, Your Honor. Everyone. Yes, Chief Justice.
And how did you do that?
I did it by form verbally, but I had forms for everyone.
You had forms, and you were able to provide those forms to the Bar Association, yes or no?
Yes.
Okay.
Then the fifth thing that they had here was they demanded that I file a withdrawal. Now, this is in 214, that I withdraw from a case that ended in September and August of the year before. Now, that docket was frozen. And
Counsel, if I can go back to that last question you just had with the Chief.
Yes,
I'm looking at paragraph 17 of the hearing. Respondent, that's you.
Yes.
Admitted at the hearing he had never personally carried malpractice insurance.
Correct.
Which you've said today. He never advised Goldner of that fact or represented Goldner with a notice to sign acknowledging his lack of malpractice coverage. Are they wrong?
They are. That's their supposition. The point with Mr. Goldner is that's an individual. My clients were two corporate entities, an LLC and an Inc. The only representative I ever dealt with was here in Columbus, a fellow named Rick Ehrenholt. Signed their contracts. He hired me. I worked on 7 different cases for these people. I had worked with Mr. Ehrenholt before he got to that for over 20 years.
You're saying Mr. Goldner was not your client?
No, absolutely not. No, and that's another fallacy that we get to in a minute. Thank you for taking me on that lead. Mr. Goldner was not the client. I was charged with writing a letter, this is the next one on my list, to Mr. Goldner. Mr. Goldner was never the client, nor was he the client of Retzel and Andrus, nor of Steve Jones. That was all what the Columbus Bar Association decided to do. They decided to package this up. Mr. Goldner was never, I never talked with him, never met him, never went to Chicago until after the case was filed. Mr. Goldner's testimony was so out of left field, nobody could have believed it. Shouldn't have believed it. He testified that I was the attorney that brought the plaintiff's case that he lost. No, it was brought by a tenant that sued them. We were defendants. We accepted the case. The man had lost touch so dramatically that he didn't know that wasn't the case. Now, what they've done is the Bar Association is supposed to be the investigator, and they're supposed to then be the reporter. And if I have an impropriety,
counsel,
then
counsel, I'm still hung up on your insurance coverage here.
Yes.
Did you present to the disciplinary council proof of insurance for this period of time?
Yes. Or proof of insurance? No, I don't have insurance.
You don't have insurance?
No, I never have. Never my whole career, 30-some years.
Didn't you just tell me you had insurance?
Oh, I never had insurance. I have always provided the form. Never had insurance.
You what?
I've never had insurance. I've always provided the client the form.
To let them know that you didn't have insurance. And
yes,
did you provide that form to the disciplinary council?
2, Your Honor. I had 3 with this particular clients. There's 2 clients. I had 3. One was destroyed in the flood, but the others were electronically saved. So those I had. And I presented those immediately as upon request for this client.
I want to be clear here. You're saying you gave to disciplinary counsel a form that was signed by the client acknowledging?
By the agent for the client, Rick Ehrenholt. Both signed by Rick Ehrenholt. The third one that was destroyed would have been signed by him too, but I don't have that. That was a paper one that was just destroyed. I mean, my office was flooded. I lost over 50 boxes. I lost everything. I lost 5 computers. I lost everything. And this is interesting because when we get into the rest of the hearing, there was no witness to contradict me. Nobody came. So I've lost due process because the second part of this case is what springs out of Vermont. I've been accused of stealing money. They keep saying, and they keep getting published in the Dispatch, that I'm laundering money. There are accounts in Vermont that I have provided you the investigation of the Vermont authorities, three different investigations, say there was no money stolen. Mr. Nice didn't do anything improper. He didn't do anything improper. These accounts, he migrated those accounts. And that's what it is in Vermont. I mean, 600,000 people. Everybody knows everybody. Those are clear that I didn't do that. Those have been submitted right with my answer. But even more important, the United States District Court of Vermont has now determined that the other part that the panel says I did wrong was I did something wrong with transferring my mother's house. The court has said that's not true. Mr. Nice did nothing wrong. And they've come out with a decision which I provided you in the motion that I filed because it was as fast as I could get it to you. I've filed a motion at the beginning to say, please let me get the litigation done before you take me around on this. In the first case, the four that we're just talking about with Retzel and Andrus were the folks demanded I do this work. Bar Association makes no demands like that. They investigate and then they relate. But the point for me is I've asked, I was denied. I couldn't even get them in Vermont. In Vermont, I had 9 cases going at one time while this was going on. 6 of them I won. Didn't settle them. I won them completely outright. The U.S. District Court judge now has said there are no damages to the other side. Why? Because the panel here says, Mr. Nice, you didn't pay your mom's medical costs in which she's at the nursing home. They were paid at the end of 2015. And then they were logged on the books. But the attorney up there wanted to drag out litigation. And so it was kept secret. She actually went to the Attorney General of Vermont, and I can prove this. I've never lied in this case. I've never lied in court. I'm not starting today. The Attorney General of Vermont said, no, they've told us, the other side, the Vermont attorneys, that they've never been paid. And so we got a judge in Vermont to have a hearing, administrative law judge for the state of Vermont. And the judge said, sure you were paid. I've got proof. It's our agency. All they have to do is walk down the hall. And they had proof that they'd been paid, completely paid. So there's nothing. Every one of the claims that have been made are false. They are false. I haven't had the opportunity for due process. We were told we would get a 3-day hearing for the panel so I could stage my witness. Didn't have a lot of them because I can't get people from Vermont, but I can do well. I can get people here. It decided during the first day that we're going to finish the first day. So Columbus Bar Association got from morning till after dinner time. I got a couple hours in the evening to present me, so I go. The next day, they cancel. We're not coming back. We'll reschedule you. We'll get you back. Mr. Nice, you can finish up what you want to give on your case. I was their witness for the first time. That's fine. But the point was I didn't even have a chance to do that. We went from 3 because the panel decided they don't want to hear any of the evidence. It's the Dilbert cartoon in the Columbus Dispatch. The Dilbert cartoons for the last 3 weeks have Dilbert painted as a liar. And the more people call him a liar and call him a liar and call him a liar, as what the Bar Association has done in this case, the reality becomes the false reality.
Let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
Order from the court adjudicating something in Vermont?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is the order?
The order is a decision that the entire process of the sale of the residence of the family was handled by a Vermont lawyer appropriately, and he made a mistake. He gave a power of attorney out, and the court has then gone through and said that house transferred as far as Kinsley is concerned, the family, and I have a brother, but as far as they're concerned, they did absolutely nothing, and the house is no longer part of the estate.
Was that there was some money that was transferred, over $500,000, into your IOLTA account, and
that's
nursing
separate
homes
from the house,
were owed money.
But they aren't. That's the other Columbus Bar Association false presentation, and they repeatedly make it, even when they know it's not true.
So
the judge's order, I'm not trying to interrupt, the order that you have that's filed with the motion is exhibit number 2 in the motion I filed last week. That one from the judge says that's not the case. That's not the case.
So the nursing homes have been paid in full?
And that order from the federal U.S. district judge says
that's
so.
A question. I'm trying to get you to respond,
yes,
to whether or not the nursing homes have been paid in full or whether they are owed more than $200,000.
Kindred Nursing Home, which is one of them, has been paid in full. The other is another one that put the lady, my mother, on the street at 87 years old, and she was out and injured with no plan. It's a violation of law. I have litigation going on with them about her injury.
But what is the amount that is owed to that home?
Right now, it looks like about $60,000.
$60,000?
I think so, Your Honor.
But there's litigation involving that issue.
But
am I right?
No, not exactly.
Okay.
That first nursing home is on Pearl Street, so that's how it's referred, Pearl Street. That nursing home on Pearl Street was paid right up until the time by me, in full, every penny, up to the point where they put my mother on the street.
Okay. Let me ask you a different question. Was the money transferred from your mother's account into your IOLTA account?
No, was not.
There was not some $500,000 placed in your...
It was not transferred. Your question, I answered it honestly. My brother went to Vermont, unbeknownst to me, and went to numerous accounts, to which he, in every case with my mother, was a co-owner of an account. So it's not my mother's account, it's my mother and my brother's. Some of them my mother put my name on, or my father did before he died. My brother got all checks except one, except two. The second one of those was in only my mother's and my name, didn't know it. So once I went up to see my mother in Vermont, my mother said, I want you to take that money, I want you to apply it based upon the people that we need to take care of. And those are all defined. Those are clients of mine. There was 11 then.
Let me ask you a different question. Has there been a final accounting submitted in the Vermont court closing out your mother's estate?
No, the probate court awaits the federal district court's conclusion. That's their rules. The federal district court has now said, though, in its order, which you have, that there are no assets to go to the estate. Absolutely none.
Okay.
But that is in the order.
Okay.
Chief, I didn't know if you were asking me.
You've used your time. You may sit down.
Thank you. Because I was responding to questions, I would still get my rebuttal time. I was responding after the 3 minutes only to that.
Counsel, you may sit down.
Thank you.
Mr. Nolder.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court, I'm Steve Nolder. I'm counsel on behalf of the Verlator, the Columbus Bar Association. And if I could first tackle a couple of issues that Mr. Nice raised in his presentation, the first would be the motion that he filed last week. And I would have to tell you that that motion's a red herring, because that motion is predicated on a disciplinary complaint that a lawyer who represents one of the nursing homes, Stephanie Tamula, had filed with the Columbus Bar Association back in March before the complaint in this case was even filed. The substance of that complaint that Ms. Tamula filed alerted to the Bar Association to the fact that Mr. Nice had engaged in self-dealing, that he was his mother's power of attorney, and using that power of attorney, he transferred her interest in real property to himself. But it turns out that power of attorney was defective. And so that's what all this litigation that Mr. Nice is talking about references, and that's what the essence of his motion is. The problem is that property transaction, even though the complaint was made to the Bar Association has never acted upon that. It's in the deferred list. And there are four counts to the amended complaint, all of which Mr. Nice was found responsible for by the panel and the board in this case. The only hint of a connection of Vermont to Mr. Nice is in count four of the amended complaint. And that amended complaint, count four, talks about commingling. Doesn't deal with real property at all. It talks about Mr. Nice's transfer of his mother's liquid assets, $580,000, from her assets in Vermont, depositing non-client funds into his IOLTA account, and then subsequently writing three checks off his IOLTA account. One check goes to his savings account for $200,000. One check goes to an estate account that Mr. Nice had opened years before. He'd closed the estate, but mysteriously had never closed that estate account. And the other check, $177,000, he used to purchase a condominium that was put in his wife's name and it's in a trust.
Counsel, he's represented that from whatever source, I'm presuming these monies, he's paid his mother's nursing home bill.
I think the nursing home bill has been paid, but not by him, by Medicaid.
Oh, and, okay.
And the problem is...
All right. So I guess that's what I should have asked a little differently, that he has squared away the debt that his mother had for her nursing home stay.
I think the nursing home had to initiate the action with Medicaid to get paid, and they had to allege that she was no longer able to pay her bills because her assets were liquidated.
So she became Medicaid eligible. And has Medicaid come after Mr. Nicely for the fraudulent transfer?
I don't believe that's occurred.
Pardon me?
I don't believe that's occurred. So the whole issue that's raised in the motion was filed last week's a red herring, because the only issue in Vermont is the whole notion of commingling. One of the issues I wanted to address that you raised, Chief Justice, was the issue about the 1.4 notices, because those are notices that the rules require lawyers to maintain for 5 years after giving clients notice that they do not have professional liability insurance. And that just didn't happen in this case. We have two sets of clients. The one client is Arthur Goldner and Associates and NC Plaza LLC. They own the building at 155 East Broad Street. And that was the litigation that Mr. Nice referenced that occurred in the Franklin County Common Pleas Court. And when Mr. Nice was relieved of responsibility for that appeal, successor counsel asked him pointed questions, and that is whether or not he carried professional liability insurance. And Mr. Nice never gave successor counsel at Retzel and Andrus a clear answer on that. And so as a result, the Bar Association got involved, and Mr. Nice, through counsel, did present two notices that appeared to have the signature of Rick Ehrenholt, who Mr. Nice talked about. One was a handwritten signature, and one was a type signature. And so he passed those off as compliant 1.4 notices. The problem is that Mr. Ehrenholt testified in this case that he had never seen these documents, that although one of those signatures appeared to be his, he never affixed his signature to that document. And oh, by the way, he wasn't the decision maker that could even make that decision whether to hire Mr. Nice in light of his failure to maintain professional liability insurance. And there were several other deficiencies with these documents. One, we never did get the original of either. Two, they all cited to a rule that hadn't existed in 10 years. It cited to DR1-104, not the rule of 1.4, okay? They were not signed. The panel found that one of them wasn't even signed, and that certainly they weren't dated, which was the rule requires, and certainly they didn't bear Mr. Nice's signature at all. So they were wholly non-compliant with the requirements of 1.4.
I think that is the explanation here that they were created after the fact?
That's our suspicion. But if the person whose signature is purported to be on the document says, and he testified under oath, I never saw these documents, and although this looks like my signature, I never affixed it to that document, and I had dealt with Mr. Nice over the years, so he had my signature and could easily be transposed onto that, that's certainly our suspicion. And if you look at the other clients, and at his deposition in August of 2015, we had a list, and we knew that he provided representation to 30 other clients, and we asked him about the 1.4 notices for those 30 clients, and he said he had them at his office in a box or in a three-ring binder, and he would produce those. And a year went by, and we had produced 10. That's all, 10 of the 30 that he said he would produce. And again, like the Rick Ehrenholt 1.4 notices that he tried to pass off as genuine, none of these complied. They never did get the originals. They didn't cite the right rule. They weren't signed, and many of them didn't have a date on them as well.
Counsel, did Mr. Nice have the opportunity to show that there was a flood in his office?
The issue of the flood came up not at the August 2015 deposition, but it came up in December of 2016. And he is the master at creating the false narrative, because when we had him cornered on these violations, he would create these false narratives to explain his inability to comply. And the flood was the first example of that.
But my question was, did he have an opportunity to present evidence to support his version?
At the hearing, the trial? Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yes, Your Honor.
So he had an opportunity to present a witness to say, yes, there was a flood.
Yes, and in his objections, he admitted that he had Don McTeague under subpoena, but that Mr. Teague did not testify, that he thought that we were going to call him, and we didn't call Mr. McTeague. But Mr. Nice did offer testimony about that fact, and the panel found that he was not credible on that issue.
Can you respond to his argument that he wasn't given time at the hearing? That it ended on the night, and then the next 2 days there was no hearing. That argument.
The first day of the hearing was a very long day, and I think it went close to 6 o'clock. And then after we had finished testimony for that day, we selected another date on which to come back. And we started early in the day, and I thought that everyone was of the mind that it would take 2 or 3 hours to finish the hearing, including Mr. Nice's presentation. And it went longer than even that. And at no time was Mr. Nice told that he couldn't call additional witnesses. He rested. It wasn't like that they brought out the hook and pulled him off the stage. Mr. Nice rested his case, just as we did, and it was submitted to the board. And I would say that we then submitted closing arguments maybe 3 or 4 weeks later, and at no time did he raise any issues in his closing arguments that he was deprived of the ability to present his case.
So that's new.
I'm sorry?
That's a new argument.
It came up in, I think, his objections to the, right, to the panel's findings.
But it didn't occur at the hearing.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes. And so if we don't have any other questions about the facts, I would like to turn quickly to the issue of sanctions. And in this case, whenever you have rules of professional conduct that have been found to be violated, you have to weigh mitigating and aggravating circumstances. A mitigating circumstance in this case that Mr. Nice presents is he's been a lawyer for 35 years, never having been disciplined. But the problem is on the flip side of the ledger, you have 6 very serious aggravating circumstances. And those circumstances are as follows. Mr. Nice has never cooperated in this investigation. And I think it would be hard if you look at his conduct throughout this, at his depositions, he played games, he falsified documents, he engaged in perjurious testimony throughout. It would be hard to find a lawyer who was less cooperative in a disciplinary case than Mr. Nice. You have multiple acts of misconduct, counts 1 through 4 of the amended complaint, all of which were supported by not just clear and convincing evidence, but overwhelming evidence. The least serious, I'll grant you, are in count 1, where Mr. Nice failed to answer this question directly posed by counsel at Retzel and Andrus, and that is whether or not he had professional liability insurance. He continued to contact a client when successor counsel at Retzel and Andrus instructed him not to, and he failed to withdraw from this litigation as is envisioned by the local rules. Those are really not that serious violations, I'll concede that. But you get to count 2, the 1.4 violations. You get to count 3, which is something he never mentioned. 1.15, his IOLTA records. There are five documents that every lawyer has to maintain for 7 years that are embodied in that rule. And Mr. Nice never produced any records that came close to satisfying the requirements of 1.15. And then obviously you have the commingling in count 4. You have a pattern of misconduct in this case, too. If you confine your analysis to the last 5 years, Mr. Nice never notified clients that he didn't have professional liability insurance. He never maintained the 1.15 documents. And if you look at some of the shenanigans he pulled during the investigation, that just aggravated the violations that we had as well. You have a situation also, Mr. Nice has never acknowledged any wrongdoing at all. He's defiant to the bitter end. I'll give him credit for that. He's been consistent. But when you're assessing whether or not this person should be permanently disbarred or a term or an indefinite suspension, you have to ask yourself, did the person understand and gain anything from the disciplinary process? Did he learn anything? And I have to think that you would answer that no, because he's not even acknowledged what is in the clear face of wrongdoing that he is responsible for any of it at all. And then secondly, if he hasn't learned anything from the disciplinary process, are these violations likely to recur? And I think that you have to confidently answer that as well. The falsification of documents, the perjurious testimony, those certainly are aggravating circumstances as well. And I think the most bothersome part, aggravating fact, that this case presents is the issue of a dishonest motive, a selfish motive. And if you have any questions about that, I would welcome you to look at Relator's Exhibit 74, and within that you'll see a document that's labeled Plaintiff's Exhibit 4. It was admitted into evidence in this case, and that document is a letter that Mr. Nice wrote to his mother in July of 2013, not 3 weeks after he and his brother systematically liquidated her assets in these Vermont accounts. And he acknowledges in that letter that her assets have been depleted, but he's unsure as far as why they were depleted and who was responsible. But he assured her he was going to engage in an investigation, and that investigation could take him into August to learn who was responsible and why this depletion occurred. And this is after he had, and his brother had taken that money, put it into his trust account with other client funds, and then used it for their own purposes. So you have those selfish and dishonest motives as well. And I know this court likes to look at other like-kind cases to determine what the appropriate sanction is in a case. And I would be hard-pressed to tell you I found a case with this extreme misconduct. But I want to tell you about two cases that I think should guide your decision in this case. And they're cases of this court last year, 2016. And the reason I think these cases are important is both lawyers entered the disciplinary process never having been disciplined in their careers. And they both leave permanently disbarred by unanimous order of this court. And it would be the Roland case and Barboric. I may be mispronouncing Barboric, but those cases at least presented a little more mitigation than Mr. Nice's case does. Because in Roland, he was an individual, he was a lawyer about Mr. Nice's vintage, and this court found that a mitigating circumstance was that he didn't act with a selfish or dishonest motive, at least in some of the violations. In Barboric, she had mental health issues. She was a pillar of her community. She was actively engaged in her community, and she'd made full restitution. But the violations in those cases certainly outweighed those mitigating factors, because in Roland, we had 1.15 violations. We had multiple acts of misconduct. We had some theft involved as well. Barboric, we had 1.4, 1.15 violations, as well as theft. And she actually engaged in deceit before the tribunal that hurt her disciplinary case. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back in this court and tilted the sanction in the favor of permanent disbarment. And I know that your goal and your objective here is not to punish lawyers, but instead it's to safeguard the public, to protect the public from unscrupulous lawyers. And if you look at how Mr. Nice has behaved when the bright light of this disciplinary process started shining upon him, I don't see how you can say that Mr. Nice would ever not again victimize the public if he were to be a lawyer. And I would ask you to affirm the panel's decision, the board's decision, the Bar Association's recommendation, and that is permanently disbar Mr. Nice. If the court has no other questions, I've concluded my argument.
Thank you. Mr. Nice, you may take a minute.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Ohio versus Rayner, 532 U.S. 17, which is cited elsewhere in my material, as well as 414 U.S. 70, which is Lefowitz versus Turley, and Spivak versus Klein, 385 U.S. 511, require that an attorney in this process be given certain protections. One is due process, the other is 14th Amendment. The example, just give you one that came up, the false statements that were just presented here again. That money that came from Vermont into that IOLTA account went in that IOLTA account, completely transparent. There's no issue about it. The documents given to the Columbus Bar Association twice, which were my IOLTA accounts, the first time I gave it, I did it grudgingly because I was told by my counsel, Nelson Genshaft, to do it. So I gave it and I brought it down. I had it with the discs. I got a receipt for it.
Counselor, did you use that money to pay your mother's nursing home bills?
No, I used my money to pay it.
You didn't, the Medicaid didn't pay your mother's nursing home bills?
There's two nursing homes. The first one is Burlington Health and Rehab on Pearl. I paid all that myself. That was all before the money moved out.
There was no Medicaid?
No.
Okay.
So I paid all that. That was me personally. It had nothing to do with the money. The money that came out and moved into my old account is not my money. It's not been taken by me. It came into my OLTA account because it was owned by more than one person. It was owned by three clients. There were 11 clients that were had right to those funds. And two
this
of those.
This is your mother's funds.
No, they're not. That's the other misconception. All the money belonged to multiple people in the accounts in Vermont, not my mother. Not my dad was long gone, but wasn't my mother. That's a fallacy. And all the documents presented at the hearing show that they weren't my mother's funds. So no matter how many times the lie is told, they weren't my mother's funds. I had to bring those back and essentially bring them back and put them in and then sort out with each one of 11, which became nine people, what to do with those funds, get their approval, get their plan, get their agreement. I had three independent parties.
Where did the funds come from?
The funds came from, I think 11 accounts in Vermont.
Well, in whose name were those accounts in?
The accounts were in the name originally of George F. Nice, then Barbara L. Nice, then Roger Nice, some mixture of those. And then over time, my mother put my name on those. And those names that my name was put on was to take care of everything. You've got documents that I presented to you already. They come right out of the investigators from Vermont. It's Exhibit 2 in my answer. In Exhibit 2, the state of Vermont's investigators that come out and examine all this went to each bank, laid out everything, and then they said, Mr. Nice and his brother didn't steal anything from Mrs. Nice and Barbara. They didn't do anything wrong. There's a family called Fortin, Brian and Missy Fortin. It's right in the document saying that they had stolen money from her, but it was not their job to try to go after these people to get that money. So when we get this reference, and I'm trying to figure out what happened to money, we're talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of $120,000. What's referenced in those documents are $17,000, $34,000, and $4,000. Now, if I'm a buck off, I'm not trying to lie to you, but that's what I believe they say. That's the state of Ohio's document. That's not me. So when I come in here and I'm talking to you all, and when I present here, everything I have said from beginning to the end is true. This idea that I have some conception of having brought that money back, I was told by my clients to do three things with approximately a third of the money. I have done exactly what those clients have demanded me to do. What I've had trouble with these folks is they don't understand that clients, you don't disclose clients and clients' business unless the client approves it. That's the rule. I didn't make the rule. I'm following the rule. So when I have the IOLTA account, the first time I give it to them, exactly the pages. I didn't redact or anything.
Mr. Nice, are they legal clients?
Yes.
They are clients of your law firm?
Yes.
So then why wouldn't you be able to at least identify who they are? You think that's privileged and you don't have to do that?
The rule says specifically that I can't go to a party and say who a client is. I can't identify a client unless the client, and I apologize, I have that rule back here, but I can't. I think it's 1.9, but 1.8. But I don't memorize well like that. But I know when I look it up and it says you can't identify a client. I gave them, though, all the money, my IOLTA with everything. The only thing I ever did on the second time, and I'll tell you why, I hope you give me a chance, on the second time I did it, I covered up because they said they never got it. I covered up the middle of my spreadsheet that said who the people were. But they weren't denied that information. I wasn't giving it to them. They went to Huntington with a subpoena and got everything. They had everything, money going in, money going out. So what they claim I denied, I was simply trying to follow the rules. Says I'm not allowed to disclose. But here's why I covered it up on the second time I provided it. The first time,
I'm in court, in a probate court in Vermont. I've never been there before. I've got counsel, but I'm an attorney, and I'm also an executor there, after the attorneys there committed a fraud against the court saying there was no will. Vermont law is very different than here. But so I'm there now, and I've got counsel, and I'm counsel. And the other side says, but Mr. Nice, and he holds up that page of my old account. Now, there's nobody in the world had that except for me and the Columbus Bar Association. Holds it up and goes right to the middle. He put the money in his trust account. Doggone right I put it in. That's as transparent as life can be. I'm not hiding anything. I'm not doing anything. I'm putting it there and waiting until my clients tell me what to do. It took a long time.
I think you've answered my question.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
You have a question?
No, go ahead.
I was going to conclude. Unless
Thank you, Chief Justice.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decisions. Marcia, we call a recess.